Well, welcome, everybody. It's a great joy to welcome you to St. Peter's Barge this evening. My name is Callum. I'm the Associate Minister here at the Barge, and it's a great delight to be joined by John Young. John, we obviously know that you are the CBO of Pfizer, but why don't you just kick us off this evening by giving us that bird's eye view of your career? How did you end up there?
Okay, thanks, Callum. It's always difficult to know how to sort of start with a general question, so I wouldn't bore you with my resume, which would probably be really boring. But I was born and brought up, as you can probably tell from the strange accent, in Scotland, so on the other side of the border. I was born in farming country, so I drove a tractor before I ever drove a car. I milked cows, I baled hay. And I was always interested in science at school, so went to Glasgow University, did a biology degree, decided it'd be a great idea to do postgrad research. So I did a year of postgrad research at Strathclyde University in immunology, which was enough to, I loved the science, but it was enough to tell me that as my career as a research scientist was going to be limited, so that shaking test tubes until I was 65 probably wasn't going to be my calling in life. So I joined Pfizer as a trainee straight out of an immunology lab in 1987, and honestly was just very blessed to be in the right place at the right time and to have opportunities in my career to do all sorts of different things. And then in 2012, I got a phone call at 5 o'clock on a Friday night from my boss, who was the CEO of the company at the time, asking me if I could be in New York on Monday morning to move to America and take on leadership of one of the businesses and join the executive team.
So it was a weekend gap.
It was literally a weekend gap where my wife and I had to figure out how big of a suitcase I was going to pack and how much stuff I was going to lug over to my hotel and all of that kind of stuff. So literally that was how it happened.
And looking back over the career, what would be some of the highlights that you've had?
It's a great question because obviously everybody, I think, in the course of your career, you know, there are all sorts of things. Hopefully, we have the opportunity to feel proud about or that we made a difference, you know, about. I actually feel really proud to have worked for a company that has developed medicines that make such a difference to human disease. So one of the earliest things that I did, Callum, was actually in the first couple of years of my career at the company, in the 1980s, when HIV was, you know, a big deal because there were no effective antiretroviral drugs for AIDS, and Pfizer developed an antifungal drug that actually was incredibly helpful because many patients with HIV/AIDS died of fungal infections, and so being able to introduce, you know, that product to physicians who are treating patients with HIV, I still look back on as something that I feel very proud to have played a part in. When I was in Australia, we lived in Australia for 3 years. I led the industry association there and did helped to lead a lot of policy work with the Australian government to reform their PBS, which is, you know, very techie and boring, but, you know, it made a big difference fiscally to Australia, but also in terms of the ability for Australians to access innovative medicines. And then, you know, for the last couple of years before I left Pfizer, which is probably where I lost the last of my hair, I spent, in common with lots of other people at Pfizer, 2 years doing almost nothing but working on the vaccine program. So that definitely was a highlight.
And what was it specifically about the role that you really enjoyed?
I really enjoyed the people that I worked with. You know, working for a company like a Pfizer, you got to work with great people. I learned something every single day. Every single day, there was variety in what you were doing. You were dealing with, you know, helping, you know, people in your team with their career journeys on one hand, and then on the other hand, making what turned out to be, you know, multi-billion-dollar decisions about how much money we were prepared to put at risk in terms of building a supply chain for a vaccine product that nobody had ever made before, realizing that if our clinical studies failed, you know, the world would be deprived of a vaccine, and, you know, we would have a supply chain that was built to make a product we didn't have. So, you know, those sort of, you know, tensions between, you know, small but important things for individual people, which I've always taken really seriously, And then, you know, being part of making some big decisions that had a lot of money behind them. But in the course of COVID, it was never really about money. It was actually more about, I think, the sense of responsibility we all felt to try to bring to the world a vaccine that could be safe and effective and be a part of helping to bring the pandemic to an end. So all of that.
And you've touched on tough times, but specifically in the job, were there things that where you were like, this is just hard, I'm not actually enjoying this?
Very rarely, I have to say. You know, occasionally, you know, in any big company, you can sort of think, oh, this is frustrating, this is difficult, and so on. But actually, I think, at least in my case, I feel very blessed as a scientist. The passion I've always had is to help to translate science into something that can make a difference to a patient, you know, who is suffering. And I feel very privileged to have, you know, got to spend the greater part of my working life doing that. So, you know, I'd be lying if I said every day was smooth sailing and, you know, it was never, you know, tough sledding at times. But honestly, I just feel really privileged because I know a lot of my friends outside of work, you know, don't necessarily have that feeling of satisfaction that honestly most of the time I felt.
And we'll talk a little bit about your faith shortly. You've got a faith in Jesus Christ. You're a Christian. But there may well be people who are thinking, why would a scientist by training have faith in Jesus? Aren't the two completely incompatible? Before we sort of talk all things pandemic and Jesus, just give us the sort of the headlines on Jesus and science.
Well, there are many far more able and qualified scientists than me in the world. All I would say is that I personally have never found a contradiction between science and faith. In fact, other people who are astrophysicists, who are geneticists, who are biologists, who are, again, far more learned and qualified than me. Francis Collins, who headed the NIH and the Human Genome Project, being, you know, one of those, is somebody who also is a Christian and a scientist. And so I personally have never found a contradiction in believing in a God who had created the universe and who is deeply interested in all of us as his, you know, part of his creation. And, you know, being a scientist and, you know, trying to sort of, you know, decode some of the mysteries of, you know, how the universe is being, you know, made and created. I've actually, in fact, always seen those two things as being highly complementary.
Before we talk about the pandemic, I should have actually mentioned at the beginning that you will all have the opportunity to ask John questions later. So if you were to head to slido.com, you'll be able to type in the code Faith and Pharma, just the name of the event. No capitals, no spaces. And you'll be able to log your questions there. And so we'll have a time of Q&A at the end. So I do feel free to grill John on any of his answers. but I should have mentioned that at the beginning, so apologies for that. John, could we zero in then on the pandemic? What was it like for you? Give us that sort of story of entering in and help us to see it from your perspective.
It was intense. So my mum had passed away in September 2019, just before COVID, and I flew back to the UK sometime in February. I think it was the beginning of February 2020, because we were making arrangements for mum's ashes to be interred. So we went to the churchyard and arranged, you know, for the tea afterwards and so on. And I remember saying to Anne, you know, I really hope I can, and this was going to be in March, I remember saying, I hope I can get back here next month because I really don't like the way that, you know, this COVID virus is tracking. And I remember Anne saying, oh, you know, ridiculous. <Yeah. laughs> Of course you'll be able to come back the way we probably all did in February 2020. And it literally, as being part of a global organization, you know, so we have a big organization in China, and it became obvious to us that, I mean, our Chinese organization got shut down and sent home in January 2020, that this wasn't a normal thing. So any of you who work for global organizations, you probably almost had that early warning signal to say this is different to what most of us have seen in our lifetime. And So when the world in New York, the same as London, probably shut down in March 2020, our CEO had issued a very three very simple priorities, which is continue to make, keep our colleagues safe, which was the first priority. Secondly, continue to make medicines and vaccines that patients need because existing diseases haven't gone away. And then thirdly, try to bring our science to bear to help to bring an end to the pandemic. And so with those very broad brush priorities, as a team, we sat down to kind of say, well, what are the areas that, you know, Pfizer technically has some expertise where potentially we could actually apply that scientific know-how to try to bring an end to the pandemic. And we had developed a partnership with BioNTech, our partner, about 2.5 years before the pandemic to try and develop a better vaccine for flu. So we had 2 years of basic science, which is very techie science, that it hadn't ever reached patients, but to try and design the construct of what an mRNA vaccine would look like. So we were able to move very quickly to take the learnings that we had about what that vaccine construct would look like. Believe it or not, it's actually relatively simple to swap out one piece of mRNA, which is a set of instructions to make one kind of protein, to swap it out for a different strand of mRNA, which makes a different set of instructions that happens to code for the spike protein on the surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
I'll have to take your word for that.
Yep, it's relatively simple. And so we had a vaccine program. And so, you know, I had the job of leading what Pfizer called the COVID SWAT team. We met at 5 o'clock every day, along with Michael Dolston, who's our head of R&D, Frank D'Amelio, who's our CFO, Rod McKenzie, who's our chief development officer, and anyone that we needed to make quick decisions in real time rather than waiting to say, well, our committee meeting is next month. COVID wasn't business as usual. So we kind of lived it literally 7 days a week for months. So it was very intense, but I think it was, as you would expect, very rewarding because I think all of us, we were all living under the same lockdown that everyone else was living under. We all realized that there were literally, particularly that summer of 2020, I don't know what it was like in London, but in New York, COVID got into nursing homes. And in, I think, the May and June, there were pictures on the sort of news channels of trucks outside hospitals that they had to keep all the coffins in because there were so many people who had died, largely older people or people who had some underlying immune disorder. But there were so many people who were dying that I think everybody just felt the responsibility to do our best to try to help to bring an end to the pandemic. So it was hard work, but you know, we all sort of felt that we were there for a reason.
And were there some pretty surreal moments for you during the pandemic where you're thinking, am I really the person doing this?
Yeah, well, 2020 in the United States was also an election year. If you remember, it was a more than strange election season. So President Trump had started Project Warp Speed. So trying to navigate through, I would say, the politics of the vaccine was very strange. So with, Dr. Fauci and, you know, the sort of team who were making decisions around the vaccine programs as they were at the time, it was very difficult because the virus, as far as I know, votes neither Democrat or Republican. And yet it was very strange how political COVID became in the United States in a way that I don't think it did in Europe or the UK, but it became very political. It was very challenging to make your way through that. We, as a company, made a decision, a very active choice, not to take government money. And we only did it because we feared that if we took a lot of government money to fund our program, although it would have been nice to have, but we would end up understandably being slowed down. You know, if you take $1 billion of the government money, government's money, quite rightly, they're going to want to know what you're doing with it. And we just knew that they were going to want to review every single protocol, every single trial, that we're going to want to inspect every single piece of the manufacturing supply chain, separate to what the regulators were going to do anyway. So we decided not to take their money. So navigating the politics of Project Warp Speed was a challenge. I personally ended up testifying twice to Congress, the Oversight and Investigation Committee of the House. They held two COVID investigations, so for my sins, Pfizer chose me to be the representative to be the, not delegate, but nominee to testify in front of the committee. That was a little surreal. My daughter found me on Roomrater, apparently, which is a thing where people critique the vaccine and COVID when everybody was virtual. There was a thing, apparently, on Twitter called Roomrater where people would critique your background. So, small parenthesis, sorry, Callum. In my study in the United States, I had a green skateboard that sat at the back of my study, and apparently this became a trend on Twitter on the afternoon that I testified. Anyway, that's an aside. What else was strange? We had a lot to do with Kate Bingham and the UK Vaccine Task Force and the Health Minister in the UK at the time, Matt Hancock. Our UK team largely dealt with Matt in the Department of Health, but we worked very closely with the UK government to try to, who were very interested in our program. Obviously, they weren't sure if it was going to be successful, but if we were successful, they wanted to be one of the first countries to make the vaccine available, I think for good reasons. So we worked very closely with them. So anyway, there were lots and lots of memories that I carry with me to this day. Some of them were funny, and some of them less so.
Can I ask you, just out of personal interest, do you turn up in, at all in the lockdown files, the WhatsApp messages?
Not as far as I know. And whatever it is, 200 and how many thousand sort of text messages. I haven't chosen to search to find if John Young's mentioned there.
We'll keep an eye out.
Yeah, thank you. Let me know.
I mean, looking back with a bit of space post-pandemic then, are there things that you wish had just gone differently? Apart from really the big headline of you wish it hadn't happened, obviously, but the how things went, do you wish they'd gone differently?
I mean, I think from a public health perspective, I think the thing that if every government in the world were being honest and could, you know, have those decisions all over again, I think if every government had locked down 1 week earlier, the spread of the virus that, you know, particularly got into nursing homes and situations where there are older people who are undoubtedly the most vulnerable, would have saved millions of lives around the world. It wasn't something that was decisionable, but, you know, in terms of the epidemiology of the virus and the pandemic, I think every government should wish, if you could do it all over again, that you would do that. In terms of the response, you know, that we tried to make as a company and, you know, our role in that, honestly, it was one of those occasions, Callum, where very unusually for drug development, I don't know how many people in this room work for a pharma company, but the science of developing medicines and vaccines is one where your experiments fail more often than they work. And this was a situation where, as I mentioned, we were able to build off 2 years of basic science, you know, trying to develop a better flu vaccine. But pretty much everything that needed to go right went right during the process of developing the vaccine. You know, honestly, I think as a Christian, you know, it was something I prayed about personally a lot. In fact, above my desk in the States, I printed out a verse from the Bible that was incredibly meaningful to me in that situation, from 2 Corinthians that talks about, you know, God said to the Apostle Paul, "My grace is sufficient for you." And that was personally how I felt in that situation, that there was absolutely nothing. It was such a situation where I just sort of felt so completely out of my depth. Nobody had ever done this before, you know, that we were trying to accomplish. And so just asking in that place for God's grace and wisdom that I certainly felt I didn't have was enormously helpful to me personally.
And to then take us to your faith in Jesus, how was it that came about?
Well, I mentioned I was born and brought up in Scotland, so my mum was a churchgoer. I think you know, her tradition was probably we went to church because it was the thing you did. I was dragged along as a kid to go to Sunday school. I stopped going as quickly as I could possibly persuade my mum to stop dragging me along, so I probably stopped going to church at about the age of 10, so I really didn't have any faith. But I, when I went to high school in Lockerbie, which is where I come from, and my closest friend at Lockerbie Academy was a guy called David, and David came from a Christian family, and you know, he was a Christian. And so over the years that, you know, as 12-year-old boys when we first met, you know, he would share something about, you know, this guy, Jesus, and, you know, obviously we all knew Jesus as a historical figure, but the idea that Jesus was more than a historical figure was foreign to me. So he would just, you know, over the years, I guess, drop into conversation, you know, about his faith in Jesus. And I was 16 in 1980. I just sat my O-grade exams, so GCSEs for the younger members of the audience. Back in my day, they were O-grades. And I remember just sort of thinking, there just has to be more to life than this. You know, the exams had gone okay. I was, you know, getting ready to sit my, you know, hires, which are in Scotland, the sort of university entrance exams. But I just had what I can only describe as an enormous sense of dissatisfaction in my life that, you know, things looked like they were going well, and yet I just wasn't satisfied. You know, I felt, you know, I guess unhappy, but for reasons that I didn't, you know, couldn't articulate. And it felt like I had a gap in my life that I didn't understand. And so David had really just shared, you know, as I mentioned, his faith you know, with me. And I remember alone in my bedroom one night just praying and saying, if there is a God, would you make yourself known to me? And I had what I will, you know, can only describe as, I guess, in retrospect, although I didn't understand it at the time, an encounter with the Holy Spirit. And God showed up and answered that prayer to me. So my journey to faith wasn't coming to understand the doctrines of the Christian faith. It was, I guess, born out of a desperation that I needed more in my life than I had, but I didn't know what it was, and praying to say, if there is a God, would you just come into my life? And he did. And there was such a palpable experience or sense of God's presence that I can't articulate. So I had no theology. I didn't know really anything about Jesus and the cross. I didn't know anything about, you know, the doctrine of sin or any of those sort of things, but I just had met with the person of God. And a couple of weeks later, I was in an English class, I happen to remember, and David was sitting next to me, and he said something about faith, and he said, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, actually, I've become a Christian. And I remember he was like, what? And he and his parents, who were lovely, lovely people, were kind enough to invite me to their church. He bought me a Bible for Christmas that year. I didn't realize, I found the Bible very difficult to read because the only Bible that I thought existed was what I now realize is the King James Version with all of these and those. And I found it really difficult to understand. And he bought me a Bible with a modern translation that was actually easier to read. And, you know, that, I guess, is where my understanding of what had actually experientially happened to me sort of gradually fell into place over the years. So that's how I came to first know Jesus as my Savior.
Yeah. And why don't you give us just some of that differences then between discovering Jesus for yourself and the difference that he's made in your life since then. You spoke about dissatisfaction, but what are some of the differences that Jesus made pre-Jesus John and post-Jesus John?
So many, many things. I think the first thing, as I mentioned, is that the COVID pandemic being a really good example, but I have found so many times in my life where you feel that you're at the end of yourself and where you have nowhere else to turn, where you feel that you don't have the wisdom or the strength or the understanding or the whatever it might be. And to bring that sense of your personal vulnerability to God in prayer, and to know him amazingly answer those prayers in ways that don't make sense, is something which has been astonishing to me. The idea that, you know, God is genuinely interested in our lives personally. It's not an abstract interest. You know, there's some verses in the Bible that sort of say that, you know, he numbers the hairs on our head, you know, the grains of sand on a beach. I think God is deeply interested in our lives. And knowing that for me personally was one of the sort of things that has been probably the biggest part of my faith journey, to have a sense that he genuinely knows and loves us. You know, the Bible says that we are beautifully and wonderfully made. And to come to a realization that God is interested in whatever it is that is going on in our lives, and if we submit ourselves to him, he will answer those kind of prayers, has been amazing. And the other thing I would also say is that I've realized in my faith journey that, you know, sometimes the Lord will ask us to do things that we would not otherwise have chosen to do. I mentioned that we lived in Australia for 3 years. I think I mentioned the last time I was here that our three girls were almost 10 and 6 at the time. So, you know, in some ways an ideal time to, you know, move from one country to the other if you're going to do that. But my mother-in-law, my wife's mother, had Alzheimer's disease. And so moving to the other side of the world when Moira, my mother-in-law, had Alzheimer's disease, particularly for Anne, my wife, was really, really hard. And yet we felt it was somehow or other, in a way that made no sense, the right thing to do. And so we trusted that the Lord somehow would work it all out, and without going into all of that. But Moira was remarkably stable for the 3 years that we lived in Australia. Her mental cognition stayed remarkably stable. And yet, you know, we found ourselves as a couple, as a family, in a position where there were so many things where all we could do was to trust that, you know, God had this in a way that we couldn't understand. And so we probably developed a prayer life and a dependence on God and that experience that we would never otherwise have had. So sometimes God will ask you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise have chosen to do, and that would be one of them.
Great. And you mentioned just briefly Jesus and his cross. Now, people here today could potentially never have heard of Jesus or never have heard the cross. We don't need a whole grand theology that I'm sure you now know, but would you maybe just give us a snapshot of why Jesus' cross is so important?
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, that sort of sense, at least that I felt, and I probably articulated at the time, you know, as emptiness in my life. You know, when I reflect on my life and I allow God to really challenge me about my life, I realize there's so much, you know, what the Americans would call junk in my life, you know, which I guess the Bible would call sin. But, you know, my pride, my selfishness, you know, the sort of areas of my life that, you know, I haven't yielded to God, that I keep to myself, all of those sort of things that are part of the human experience, you know, I guess the Bible would kind of call sin. And the thing that, you know, I realized in my walk of faith is that becoming a Christian isn't about becoming a good person, that actually he meets us where we are, including all of the sin in our lives, all of the junk, all of the baggage, all of the stuff that we feel as very imperfect human beings. And the cross is really where the great exchange happens, where Jesus, you know, the Bible says, took all of our sin and shame and guilt and all of that junk in our lives, and it was nailed to the cross. And he and took our place when he bore our sins on the cross. And that realization that God's love for us is not an abstract thing, that he loves us so much that he sent his only son, that whoever believes in him would not perish but have eternal life. And coming to know that that verse is not just, you know, a thing that people wave at a football stadium, at least in America they do, but actually that verse is deeply meaningful and deeply personal, not just to me, but to every single person on this planet, is just one of the greatest privileges I think we have as human beings.
Thanks. And you've probably met over your career a whole heap of people who are very, very skeptical about the person of Jesus and what he did. If folk here tonight are skeptical about Jesus, what would you say to them?
I would say begin that journey of exploration wherever you are in your faith journey or your exploration of Jesus. I mean, my faith journey started from a perspective of, you know, there is no God, it's all rubbish. And I guess my life was transformed because, as I said, I prayed a prayer and said, if you're real God, would you make yourself known? And he did. And so if you're in a position tonight, or you know someone is in a position tonight where you're feeling like you're looking for something more and you don't know what it is, then ask God and he will answer that prayer. He will make himself known, because the greatest thing that he wants to achieve is for all of us to have a relationship, a living, vibrant relationship with him, with the living God, with the person of Jesus. The Christian faith is not about having a set of doctrines and beliefs. It's about having a relationship with the living God, and he will answer that prayer.
And you've likely also come across many people of many different faiths. Why, as a thinking, like, adult, and you've got a faith journey to look back on yourself, but why is it that you've stuck with Jesus rather than perhaps exploring and going into another faith instead?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, the claims that Jesus makes, you know, are really quite unique, you know. And I think probably one of the sort of things compared to, you know, many of the other sort of, you know, global religions is that the Christian faith basically says, look, we know that we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, is the way that the Bible would put it. But we all know in ourselves that, you know, we have junk in our lives, if I can put it like that. And the Christian faith basically says that you'll never be able to earn your way there, but I've done it for you. And that's what Jesus did for us on the cross. And so the reality of my relationship with Jesus has been so real and so tangible to me that I've never really, since that day when I prayed that, you know, crazy prayer as a 16-year-old in my bedroom, I've never had cause to look to anyone else or anywhere else for my faith or my faith journey. It's been that real and authentic and transformational for me in my life.
And just then, to think about you yourself as a scientist, and how is it that you would say that the differences between faith and science stack up in terms of your scientific belief is obviously testing and adjusting hypotheses as things are proved or falsified. But what's the difference there then with faith?
So it's a great question, actually. You know, there is you know, a fundamental difference, because, you know, science is very empirical. You know, it relies on facts and data. I'm a pretty left-brained person, you know, so I like facts, I like data, I like numbers. That's kind of how I'm wired. And yet the journey of faith is one that, you know, asks you to put your trust in, you know, a person who, you know, is a historical figure, you know, where there's an enormous amount of historical evidence for the fact that Jesus was a real person who lived on this earth, but that he was more than just a good person or a wise teacher or whatever else. So it asks you to basically take a step of faith and trust that that God, you know, is not just an abstract person, but he genuinely is interested in having a relationship in your life with you. And so, you know, that is probably a contrast, you know, as somebody who's a scientist. And yet, as I mentioned, Callum, I've never found my faith to be, personally, to be challenged or in conflict with, you know, what I know about, you know, science and biology and, you know, all of those sort of things. But, you know, ultimately, you know, God asks us to take a step of faith and to put our trust in him.
Thanks so much. I mean, I want to make sure that you've got opportunity to ask John lots of questions tonight, and to make sure that those questions get to him. Please do go to your phones and head to slido.com. The code for the event is Faith and Pharma. And as you do that and ask John questions, it can be on anything that we've covered tonight. Let me just point out the two flyers that you'll have on your seats. The first is just our Easter events here at St. Peter's Barge. So if you're working in Canary Wharf, we've got two lunchtime talks going on next week where we'll be talking more about the death and resurrection of Jesus. And if you're in the Docklands area, then why not come along on Good Friday or Easter Sunday here at St. Peter's Barge. And we'll be talking again about Jesus and what his death and resurrection means for us. You'll see as well the bright yellow What Next card. You can fill in a QR code online and there'll be the same options as what are on the back of the cards. It's a way for us to stay in touch. There's an offer there to meet up and have a coffee with a staff member from the church here. So that'll be just finding out a bit more about how to get involved here at the church, or indeed how to explore these questions that you may well have. And there's a course called Hope Explored that we'd love to invite you along to if you would say that you don't have faith in Jesus, but you're interested in exploring the hope that he gives us. John mentioned that a great thing to do is to begin that journey by asking some questions. We love questions, and we love the people who ask them. So why not have a think about signing up for that course? It'll be meeting Tuesday evenings here just for 3 weeks. So why not have a moment to do that? And take a moment as well and get up Slido, and then we'll continue. We've got plenty of questions, but do keep them coming in. Feel free to ask more. We'll try and get through them all, so don't worry about asking too many. John, have you come across Christians who refused the COVID vaccine on religious grounds? How would you respond to them?
So in my church in the States, so I lived in Connecticut just outside New York for the last 10 years. As I mentioned, for reasons that I have to say, I'm still not sure I really understand, but the politics of COVID became very, very Democrat and Republican. So Connecticut is a blue state, a generally Democratic state. So most of my, in fact, I think all of my friends, all of the guys who were in my Saturday morning men's Bible study at my church, everybody had the vaccine. In fact, ended up on Saturday mornings getting sort of plugged literally all the way through 2020 and beyond about whether I think about this, that, and the next thing. But I know, I know of Christians, you know, who, you know, sort of decided that, you know, they were going to trust that God would keep them safe, that they didn't need the vaccine, and so on. My view has always been, you know, this is it's a public health matter. I think the data and the evidence to say population health when it comes to an infectious disease really matters, which is why the flu vaccine put COVID to one side. If you're vulnerable, having a flu vaccine, I think, is, you know, is good. If you're you know, a child having a chickenpox vaccine is good. I personally had chickenpox because there was no vaccine when I was a kid, which probably dates me, but you know, those are good things to do. But it is, and I think should be, a matter of personal choice. But it should be a matter of personal choice. As I said, I'm somebody who's fairly left-brained and tries to have my views informed by facts and data. And I think the facts and data of, if you just look at what particularly the original strains of COVID were leading to in terms of transmission and the effects of either very high risk of death in vulnerable populations, or actually for relatively healthy people suffering from long COVID, that's a significant toll. vis-a-vis what were the benefits and risks of being vaccinated. And it's one of the easiest equations that you'll ever calculate to say what are the benefits of being vaccinated significantly outweigh any risks. And so I would always say go and look at the data would be what I would say or argue. Don't go and look at somebody's blog on Twitter that, from somebody that you've never heard of. Go and look at a range of reputable sources and then use that to inform your view.
And have you ever been challenged about your faith, just in your professional context or your career? If so, did you face any conflict? How did you manage that? It can be sometimes pretty choppy waters, having a faith in a workplace and trying to also live that out.
Yeah, I mean, I think, probably the sort of areas that were most challenging, I would say, is that, particularly in the United States, probably up until COVID, big pharma, if I can use that phrase generally, did not have a great reputation. And the reputation big pharma had was all you're ever doing is, ripping off, you're stealing universities, drugs, because that's where drugs get discovered and you somehow steal them and bring them to market. And then, all you do is to jack up prices and, patients can't get in the, can't get access to those. So those are sort of things that my friends outside of work would commonly say, either there were questions that they had, or they would say, I was at a dinner party last night and somebody said, blah, what do you say about that? And so I've always, my perspective has always been be transparent and be straightforward. So, talking about, the synergy between academia that generally tends to discover targets, so they will tend to do basic research to look at a particular receptor and how it might affect a particular disease process, which is different to then developing a drug or a treatment that can actually hit that receptor and in some way make the disease process better for people. They're two different but complementary processes. And I feel very proud that, there is a genuine synergy between those. And in the United States, as chief business officer, one of the last jobs that I had was to try to do something about what were and, have been unsustainable costs that patients in the United States have to bear when it comes to accessing medicines. I mean, it is a system which is out of control. And without going into all the vagaries of, why, pricing and list pricing doesn't necessarily sort of filter through to what a patient pays, but ultimately the cost that a patient pays when they go to pick up a prescription at a pharmacy is set by an insurance company in the United States. In the UK, it's, you get a prescription charge, but in the United States, it's a very variable cost set by your insurance plan. So we really tried to do work to try and make sure that every medicine for every patient was affordable. And to give you an example, one of our Pfizer's biggest selling medicines, which was a very expensive but a cancer drug for men with prostate cancer. Prostate cancer tends to generally hit older men who are retired, who then have less disposable income. And about half of the volume of that drug was donated free to patients who couldn't afford it. So trying to put programs in place to enable medicines to be made available to anyone who needs them was something that I personally spent a lot of time trying to do. But those were hard because, frankly, you couldn't try and solve those problems quickly enough for many patients who needed them. But it was something at work that we took really seriously.
And two questions of similar veins. The Bible doesn't promise Christians like success and success in your career. How do you think your faith has helped you navigate what, looking back, is a successful career? And specifically, have there been moments where the workplace has felt like a difficult place to be a Christian?
So two different questions. So firstly, the first question about career, I mean, I come from a relatively humble background. I mean, I was, as I said, I was born and brought up on a farm, you know, doing very simple, mundane things like milking cows, driving a tractor, working in a hayfield. If you had said to that 16-year-old John that I would end up doing what I would have doing, I would have laughed at you. I had neither my mum or my dad went to university. My father was in the RAF during the war. My mum was, you know, sort of that generation as well. They didn't have the opportunity to go to university. So frankly, going to university felt aspirational for me. So the answer to that question really is, I never set out to have a career. It just ended up becoming one. Originally, you know, when I came out of university, my girlfriend at the time, who has been my wife for almost 35 years now, but we were looking to get married, and I needed a job that was going to pay a salary that would enable us to get married. So I didn't start that journey sort of thinking about a career, but we did very prayerfully try and say that, you know, we wanted to make ourselves available to God with whatever path he would call us to go on. It just ended up being a very different path to the one that we had expected. In terms of the, has it always been easy at work? I would say no, it hasn't. I mean, particularly early in my career, when I joined Pfizer as a trainee, as many of you will probably know, you know, drinking culture, you know, is a big deal, you know, in many work environments in the UK. At least back in the sort of 80s when I first started in the sales organization, it was a big part of sales meetings and so on. And, you know, getting drunk wasn't something that I did. So, you know, I would, you know, as you do, get, you know, probably generally good-natured, you know, comments about, you know, being a Christian and being boring and all of those sort of things. So, you know, it wasn't always easy. But honestly, I never really viewed it as being the hardest thing in life. If that's the worst thing that ever happened to me, it wouldn't be too bad. But, you know, in any environment, if you feel like you're the outsider, you know, it can be difficult sometimes.
And a lot of that excessive culture can also come from handling stress. How did you find handling stress? There have obviously been plenty of stressful moments.
Genuinely, I mentioned it earlier, Callum, but although it's probably a cliche, but one of the sort of things that I've always found in my life is that at points in my life where I felt that I have nothing else left to give, where I have nowhere else to go, just bringing that sense of being, you know, beyond yourself to God in prayer, and just laying that burden, whatever that was, whether that was a worry about, you know, a project, or I have to have a difficult conversation with somebody at work, or whatever it might be, bringing that to God in prayer and saying, you know, Lord, I really don't know what to do. I just give it to you, and I just ask that, you know, you would be with me in this, was honestly the way that I dealt with stress. During the pandemic, one of the sort of things that I probably did more than almost any other time of my life was to listen to worship music. I find that in the same way that I think with a relationship with a human being, you know, you spend time together with, you know, somebody in your family or somebody who you're close to, intimately. And as you get to know somebody intimately, you build trust with that person. And actually, I think the same is true with our walk with God. And in that, you know, what otherwise would have been, I think, you know, potentially quite a lonely situation with my family here, and I was in the States on my own. But I spent a lot of time listening to worship music, which I found enormously helpful to just spend time at the end of the day in God's presence, you know, in my living room. I just, you know, stream, you know, a worship album or something like that. And I found it to be incredibly helpful to just spend time in God's presence as a way to kind of just lay it all down at the foot of the cross, because I knew I couldn't bear it.
And two really similar questions to each other. Why would God allow a pandemic that has devastated so many lives? And did witnessing so many people die of COVID. Did that rock your faith in a loving God?
So two different questions again, I think. So first question, why did it happen? Why did God allow it? I don't think, personal view, I'm not sure that the truth about the origins of the pandemic or the facts about the origins of the pandemic are fully known by anyone yet. And I think that flawed decisions, you know, played a large part in this becoming the global pandemic that it was and leading to the magnitude of devastating loss of life that it did. You know, personally, I think if the WHO and China had been more forthcoming initially about the origins of the pandemic, I think that would have been helpful. I think many governments, you know, were for all sorts of, you know, good reasons, you know, slow to, you know, make decisions about lockdown. And so, you know, I guess that that flawedness of human nature, I think, you know, undoubtedly had a part to play in how great, you know, the pandemic became and consequently how great a loss of life, you know, there was. So, you know, it has never caused me to lose my faith or question my faith because, in large part, you know, I felt privileged to have been able to play a small part in one of the organizations that was helping to bring an end to, you know, an enormous amount of human suffering. So, in a bizarre kind of a way, it felt, you know, like a privilege to try and do something of service to the world in a small way in my case.
And then your faith being rocked at all, witnessing just so much suffering?
I mean, I think the question of, you know, God and suffering, I think for every Christian, I mean, not just in the pandemic, for every Christian, you know, is a really, remains a very difficult question. I know one of the sort of books that I never used to understand in the Bible, but I think is in some ways satisfying and in some ways dissatisfying is the book of Job. So, you know, Job is this figure in the Bible where lots of bad stuff happens to him in the course of his journey. And then he has these friends who come to try and offer him comfort. And there is no, the Bible actually doesn't give a reason as to why Job suffered. But at the end of the book, ultimately, you know, what Job realized was the answer not to why he suffered, but the answer to his questions was God. And so, you know, I couldn't claim to sit up here, Callum, and give anybody in this audience an answer to the question of why does God allow suffering in the world? I know a lot of suffering is caused by us, by the stuff that human beings do that is wrong and, you know, selfish or prideful or, you know, wars happen largely because of human beings, not because God is, you know, causing one nation to fight the other. But that question of why does someone have cancer? Why does, you know, somebody have heart disease or whatever it might be? I don't have an answer to that. But I do know that, you know, in whatever that, you know, place of suffering is, and every human being in this room has known some kind of difficulty or suffering. And I do know that in whatever your journey is and whatever your experience of suffering or difficulty has been, that God will meet you in that place and will, in a way that doesn't make sense, give you an answer to the question of, you know, why, or at least help you to make your way through.
And the Bible is significantly clearer on the problem of death itself. And the solution to it. You obviously saw a lot of death during the pandemic. What would you say is just a minute on the Bible's solution to death?
Well, the Bible's solution to death is that death is not the ultimate end. You know, one of the sort of things about the Christian faith, which is an enormous joy, is the promise that actually this world is not it, that actually there is an eternity, which is a concept that most of us, and I would say I struggle to fully comprehend. I'm not sure if any of us fully comprehend exactly what eternity is going to be like. And yet we have the promise that actually as a believer, it's not just that, you know, Jesus will make our life here on this planet a bit better and then we die, that actually there is an eternity beyond that. And so, you know, that for me is the ultimate satisfaction, I think, that beyond this life, we have the promise when we put our faith and our trust in Jesus of eternal, you know, life with him. And to be not just, you know, an eternity, you know, I used to struggle with this question of, okay, what exactly does everybody do in heaven? You know, when you get there, what exactly are you going to do? But there is that sense that if we are genuinely made for God, we're part of his creation, that we're actually, we're going to be made complete in a way that we see partially in this life when we become Christians. And yet I think the promise as a Christian is that when we die, that isn't it. We actually go to be with our Maker, with the one who made us and who knows us better than anyone else, and to find all of those imperfections in our lives to be made perfect by the one who made us. And that, for me, is the ultimate answer to the question of what beyond death.
Thanks. To take us on a slightly different track then, you obviously have now retired. We didn't actually cover what you're up to now. What is it that you're doing, and what led you into those new fields and pastures new?
Well, when I retired, so after 35 years at Pfizer and having spent 2 years in COVID, that, as I say, was pretty intense, my oldest daughter got engaged and then married last year. But when she got engaged, I really sort of felt I'd really like on the day that she gets married to be her dad and not have a piece of my brain thinking about the latest crisis in the Pfizer universe somewhere. So I blame Emma as the reason that I finally decided to call it a day. That passion to try to bring the experiences that you get when you work for a company like a Pfizer to translate science into innovative medicines or therapies that can make a difference to patients is something I really still care about a lot. So I serve on the board of two small, one very small, one publicly listed biotech company. I've just joined the board of Novartis, which is a large Swiss pharma company. And I'm on the board of an engineering company called Johnson Controls that basically aims to decarbonize buildings, which has nothing at all to do with medicines or vaccines or anything like that, but actually has an incredible purpose to actually help the world, as they would put it, to either use less electrons or use green electrons as a solution to decarbonizing the world. So I serve on the boards of those companies. That's what I do, you know, work-wise now, so not quite as intense as the one job that I had prior to that, but still keeps me fully occupied so I don't get under Anne's feet at home too much. But it also gives space to go and do some other things in my life that are actually very important that I never had time to do when I was with Pfizer. So as you know, Callum, one of the sort of things that I think is a shared experience is an organization that my wife and I have supported for I think since 2005, called Jenga, which is a small, very small NGO, community development organization that does work in eastern Uganda that really tries to help or create sustainable economic development in an incredibly poor community. So I was able to physically get to Uganda finally last November. I'm going back for a month in July. So being able to just take a month and go and help with the organization and the work that they're doing and their projects is actually, alongside my board work, part of how I'm spending my time.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. The event that you did for us back in January or February or so, you spoke a lot about your faith in the workplace and navigating that as a Christian. Maybe just a couple of top tips of keeping prayer and faith central for the Christians in the room.
Yeah, I would say, look, God gives us one life. He doesn't give us a life outside of work and then a life in work. I firmly have a view that, you know, we only get to live one life, and it's a single life. And so that question, you know, for those of us who are Christians, of saying, is my life somehow different in my character at work to how I show up at church on a Sunday? I mean, it shouldn't be. If my relationship with Jesus is the central pillar of my life, then my my character should be the same at work in terms of how I care for the people in my team, the same as I care for the people in my church or the people that we're trying to serve in in Bali in Uganda. And so for me, I would always say, look, that the best people to ask would be the people in my team or my organization over the years, but I've really tried to show up the same and to have as much love and care for the people that I work with in my place of work as I do, in, my church or other settings. So I think that for me is being one sort of thing that I think as a Christian, I think we're called to do, which is to live out, our faith in the place of work, which doesn't mean preaching the gospel or Bible bashing, but it does mean living a life and showing genuine care to people in the difficulties of their lives, being invested in their career development as a senior leader, taking time to support people with their career development, providing sort of feedback in a way which is helpful and constructive, and just genuinely caring and sort of making sure that people know that they're more than a number. And that isn't just a church thing. That's actually something which is deeply embedded in, to me, what it means to be a Christian. And I've tried to live that out to the best of my ability at work as well. And I think that's what God calls all of us to do.
We've hit a lot of transformations of your life, sort of how the differences that Jesus has made. Some of those will have happened more slowly. Some will have been pretty quick. Maybe just give us a couple of the ones that happened quickly as Jesus entering in, transforming your life, and then maybe even just the ways that you see Jesus changing your life right now.
I guess the sort of transformation, for me, when I first became a Christian particularly was going from a place of, having no belief in God and thinking there wasn't anything to actually suddenly realizing not only intellectually was there a God, but I'd had an encounter, which I to this day still, believe was experientially before I sort of understood anything about Jesus, but was, a meeting with Jesus in a way that sort of, was incredibly real and transformational for my life. So it literally transformed how I saw myself. Yeah, I mentioned, my parents hadn't gone to university. I came from a fairly humble background. So even that sense that God had a plan for my life was a very radical thing to contemplate, that actually, I was known, I was loved, and actually God cared about my life was deeply transformational for me. So that was something that happened quickly, but I guess also happened slowly, because the reality of saying, okay, I understand it, but what does that actually mean practically? It means things like God is trustworthy enough to, if you feel him calling you to do something that you wouldn't otherwise choose to do, do you actually trust that actually in a way that doesn't make sense, whether it's going to Australia when your mother-in-law has Alzheimer's disease or taking a position in the United States and your family are going to remain here, or whatever sort of things it might be, do you trust that somehow he's got it in a way that might not make sense? And that is definitely a journey, not a destination that you reach, because there's always another one of those, I think, in your life somewhere around the corner.
Great. And a slightly controversial one then. You mentioned that the COVID issue became very politicized in the US. Which is a shame. What's your view on Dr. Anthony Fauci? Do you hold a view on him? Does he deserve criticism that he gets?
Oh, how long do we have?
Under 10 minutes.
Under 10 minutes. I'll make it very quick. He was in a very difficult position, dealing with, as every other scientist was, imperfect data. Particularly early in the pandemic, to make the recommendations that they were making. Some of those, I'm guessing that if he was in this room, he probably would say that some of the recommendations that they made early on in the pandemic, with the benefit of data that wasn't available then, he would probably have made different recommendations on certain things. So he was in a very difficult position at a time of incomplete data. And I think did his best, is what I would say.
Possibly even more controversial. Do you prefer Aussie rules, football or soccer?
Rugby, actually, since rugby. You ask.
There we go. Calcutta Cup holders, Scotland.
Here we are. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for bringing that up.
I think I've got these three questions together. Well, one question, but how did you perceive it's all about God's plan when experiencing all the challenges, including things getting political, delayed lockdown, widespread of infection and death increases at the period of time, as you mentioned? And how did you still hold on to the faith and also use your expertise during that period of time? Was it a huge struggle after all? So God's plan, holding on to faith, and the struggle of it.
So look, I mean, there are, as we've touched on, I think already, many things about, COVID that were, a mess and, deeply uncertain for everybody in terms of the situation that we were all living in. As a scientist, you would say, with very imperfect data about, the virus, about, how to treat it, how it spread, all of those sort of things. So I think the faith sort of piece of that to me is, since the Garden of Eden, God has had a lot of experience of dealing with human beings who think they know better than he does. COVID, I think, in human history is another example where there are many elements of the COVID story where human beings sometimes, made, the best decisions that they could and sometimes didn't. In the middle of all of that, I guess the thing which I've always held on to is God loves and cares for his people and his humanity. We are, the Bible says, his creation. And so my faith that actually that is the nature of God. It is not just a piece of his character. It's who he is. He is a God of love, the Bible says. And so as a Christian, I just found myself in this odd position that did feel like I was living somebody else's life some of the time, in a position where I could play a small part, along with, I have to say, literally thousands of others, to try to help to bring an end to the pandemic. And that's what I focused on. So it wasn't ever a challenge of faith to me. It was always, in some ways, it sounds odd to say, but almost a privilege to be in a position where you feel like I could take some of the things and experiences that I'd gained over the course of my career and try to make them available in a way that I hope would make a difference to, the world, but along with, as I say, literally thousands of other people.
And two vaccine-related questions. The virus, man-made or natural, and vaccine, could it make our immune systems weak?
Both good questions. On the first question, that's part of what I would say I think is not fully known. Where did the virus come from? Is it, an escapee from a lab, or did somebody eat a bat? And I don't know. I don't think we know. There are genuinely better scientists than me who have a point of view on both of those positions. And I would say I don't think that there is enough fact or data yet to fully answer that question. I would say the predominant point of view in the scientific community is it probably skipped from animal species to human beings, given the proximity of the famous fish market in Wuhan. There are, other scientists, again, who are better virologists than I am, who would say that when you look at certain sequences in the original SARS-CoV-2 virus, they're remarkably akin to gain-of-function gene sequences, which you find in certain viruses. So I don't know is the answer to that question. In some ways, it almost doesn't matter, but I've heard and read about points of view that would suggest both. The second question was
Could the vaccine make immune systems weak?
Could it make immune systems weak? It would be very unlikely for a vaccine to make an immune system weak. The reason being that all any vaccine, including but not limited to the COVID vaccine, does is to introduce an antigen. So an antigen is basically, it's kind of like a biological shape that your body recognizes and then makes antibodies against, is probably the simplest description. So the act of your body making an antibody against a foreign structure, like an antigen, in this case, it happened to be the spike protein on the surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, is biologically very unlikely to weaken an immune system that you have already. If you have an already weakened immune system, so if you were receiving chemotherapy or you had HIV or you were immunosuppressed in some way, if you received a vaccine, whether it's for COVID or for anything else, sometimes because it has suppressed your immune system doesn't have enough gas in the tank to be able to make antibodies against what it is you've been vaccinated against. But it isn't the vaccine that's caused your immune system to become weak. That would be in very particular diseases or conditions where your immune system is already suppressed. I don't know if that's too techie, but
it's my best attempt. Just about with you. Just
all right,
about.
It's my best attempt to make it.
Before we finish up tonight, let me just remind you about the midweek talks going on next week. There'll be lunchtime here and over at the Idea Store. Let me encourage you to fill in the What Next card. You can do it online or on paper, and you can just leave that with us. And that's an opportunity to sign up to a Hope Explored course to have a look and to explore about more questions that you might have about Jesus. But John, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And thank you for taking all our questions, taking the time out of your busy life to do this for us. So we really appreciate it. Let's show John our appreciation.